Good day, and welcome to this Bar Coding conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over. I apologize. Before I turn the call over to Ms. Schaefer, I'd like to remind everyone that we are going to have an open and interactive conference today. This does mean that all lines will be open. You may ask a question at any time. We simply ask that you please use your mute button when not speaking to help keep the background noise to a minimum. And now I will turn the conference over to Ms. Marguerite Schaefer. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first of three conference calls focused on information technology. We have with us today Dr. Charles Stimler, who's going to be the keynote speaker, Doreen Bedalis-Nguyen, who's the project manager, as well as Bill Gardner, Suzanne Columbus listening in. I know that you have all expressed interest in participating in the Health Information Technology IPG, and we do welcome you. Nationally, I know all of you are aware that the medical community is looking at IT solutions, and knowing this, that it's on everyone's radar screen, CMS has made it a major focus for the ACE scope of work. And I know that some of you may already be using various IT strategies within your hospital, while others may be just beginning to look at what would be best to meet their needs. CMS's goal, and therefore IPRO's goal, for the ACE scope of work, looking at IT solutions, is to assist hospitals over the next couple of years to assess where you are, work with you to develop or build a strategic plan for eventual implementation, and then to reassess your readiness at the end of a couple of years. And I just want to make mention of the fact that in order to participate in the IPG, and I know many of you have already had conference calls with Doreen Bedaw, the project manager, but I just want to reiterate these key points. In order to participate in the IPG, we need your CEO to sign and return the MOA that has been sent to each of the interested hospitals, complete an assessment by January 15th, and work with IPRO to develop a strategic plan for implementation. We have various tools designed to guide you in this endeavor. We all know that planning is a very necessary component to the success of any IT implementation, and certainly we feel that for most of us this is a win-win situation. We're all looking at this, we're all focusing on it in the medical community, and we do feel that we've got a lot of very good tools that will assist you in your strategic plan. Our objective for today's call is to review the bar coding assessment tool, cover various aspects of the assessment tool, and help you to begin completion and hopefully facilitate the completion of the assessment tool. If you have any questions, we hope that we will be able to answer them for you. And that being said, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Stimler, our medical director for the hospital projects. Dr. Stimler?
Yes, Peggy, thank you very much. I'm going to now go ahead and start to introduce what we're going to be doing today. We've made this a very interactive conference call for a very specific reason, that I see this as being something that will be more useful for everyone if people feel completely comfortable at any point asking questions and offering possibly answers or assistance with issues that may come up as we go through some of these survey questions. These surveys are rather challenging. I think BPOC or barcoding, the one we're going to do today, is no exception to that. This is an extremely long survey that's quite technically detailed, and I kind of conjured up in my mind the idea of trying to do this, at least initially, in the context of sort of this workshop conference call, so that we could, as a group, go through these questions and possibly clarify issues that will come up with a real intent on simplifying these questions to try to make them much more easy to answer and less imposing. A couple of observations that I've made about the surveys that I hope will be helpful for you. It appears to me, and I would imagine that it appears to many of you, that these surveys, that especially BPOC, this survey appears to be derived from a checklist, essentially. A checklist that would probably contain ideal elements of processes or policies that would facilitate and augment the effectiveness of BPOC. If this were used as a checklist, I think it would be extremely helpful. I think it's somewhat less useful as a survey only because the checklist items don't lend themselves as easily to kind of objective evaluation. But nevertheless, we're going to do the best we can with it. Another observation that we will encounter as we go through this is that there are wide areas of overlap and redundancy in the survey. There are many questions that kind of get at the same issue from slightly different points of view. Nevertheless, I think we're going to recognize this when this comes up, and we're going to do the best we can to handle that. There are a couple of questions that actually may be somewhat controversial, at least to me, as to whether or not they are desirable for implementation. I think any time you get a group of best practices together, there always will be for everyone a few that, you know, people don't necessarily agree with. I think on the large part, most of them are really excellent points, though. I think that it's probably practically impossible for a hospital to be able to accomplish 100% of all of these items, and I'll just say that up front. This is kind of like the ideal world where you've got hundreds of items on a checklist. It would be great if all could do all of them, but I think that practically speaking, it will be impossible. Therefore, don't feel that you have to answer yes to every question. I don't think there's any kind of a feeling of failure if you feel that you need to answer no to some questions. Clearly, also, this is a baseline survey, so that this is not supposed to be your best performance. This is going to be a baseline performance where many hospitals will actually be will not have implemented most of these interventions. That's the whole point of this IPG, is that as we go through the next 2 years, we will implement these interventions, and or we'll at least move towards a greater readiness to implement these interventions and possibly work along some progress along these checklists. It is the improvement over time and not the baseline score that reflects the good or bad in terms of the survey. The way the worse you look on the baseline, the easier it is to actually look better on the subsequent survey. The purpose, this is a very non-punitive survey. I mean, actually, I've been told that we're going to be recording total scores with CMS, but they're not interested in individual answers to questions. So it's really, the whole purpose of the scores is really to assess the QIO. Ultimately, it is IPRO that is being assessed here. It is our effectiveness in helping you out that is what these scores are going to be used for. So your scores on these surveys before a baseline and then at the intervention in about 2 years are going to reflect to CMS how effective IPRO has been in terms of helping you. It's really feedback to CMS for the things that we were able to accomplish. We're going to try to answer each question as best as possible. There may be some questions that will be necessary to make an educated guess or at least to include a number of assumptions. And I also want to just point out that I don't think the survey is a validated instrument, so that I see its primary utility really as a strategy map and a checklist to help you understand the pieces that need to fall into place to properly prepare, implement, and maintain BPOC. So I really see this whole exercise as being something that is for you and your own benefit. You should use this survey really as something that's a teaching tool. And like I said, sort of a best practices checklist. However, the reality is that we do have to complete the survey. It does have to be submitted back to IPRO. We're saying by the end of this month. We'd like to get it in by December 31st, if at all possible. If you need a few extra days past that, that's okay. Actually, I hope that possibly today, as we go through the sections and we look at the questions and we discuss them, that there will be some of you that will actually be able to complete the survey. some of you that will be able to do most of the questions, and maybe a few that will get started, but we'll actually have to check with some of your other team members to be able to fill in the rest of the questions. For the BPOC survey in particular, it is most ideal if you did have a director of pharmacy or a pharmacist as well as a clinical floor nurse available. If you look through the questions, you'll see that basically they touch on the issues of a little bit on senior administration and management, but a lot on nursing and actually what happens on the floor, as well as pharmacy, what goes on in the pharmacy, and how pharmacy interacts with the clinical units. And just as a note, after this conference call, we're going to be mailing everybody an electronic version of the survey in Excel format. And I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But why don't we move on? I'm going to plan to spend about 5 to 10 minutes on each section with the option of spending a lot longer as needed. And I think some sections will be relatively easy. Other sections are going to be far more difficult because they're going to be a lot longer and have a lot more questions. I'm going to start with the first section, and where most most everybody on the call is on mute, but as we hit a question where there's an issue or a question or you've got you need a clarification, don't hesitate to interrupt and pose that clarification. The first section, and I hope you all have your surveys in front of you as we go through it question by question. The first section is on drug labeling, packaging, and nomenclature, and it's divided into manufacturer and hospital labeling. And just, you know, looking at these questions, they're all rather different, and I'm just going to go through them. The first question is that you have a list of frequently prescribed medications, essentially, you know, is there to help facilitate barcoding. I would imagine that, you know, you may or may not have such a list. You know, it's not a problem if you don't have it, but the idea is that you need to make one because that way you know which are going to be the most frequently needed barcodes. The second question looks at high alert drugs. And these are priority drugs for barcoding, basically. These are drugs that needed to be barcoded at a unit dose level. But ideally, they all need to be at a unit dose level. So this is what I mean by some of the redundancy. All drugs should be provided at a unit dose level. But here, it's specifically looking at whether high alert drugs have been singled out as sort of the most priority drugs to be done, and you know, a question that we're going to see sort of visited over and over and over again. The third question really asks about a policy, which is that whether in general single unit medication packages with barcodes are purchased from source manufacturers. As we'll see later, that's not the only way we can get single dose medications into barcoding. But it is good to have a policy by which you try to purchase single dose directly from the manufacturer. These can be more expensive at times because they involve individual packaging. Well, in the pharmacy, there may be a need to repackage. But that, Sue, did you want to make a comment on this?
Well, you can speak with the person that does the procurement for that. With the wholesaler or the person with, or the manufacturer with the, of the medication, and I've been seeing more and more that you can make these types of arrangements with the manufacturer.
Okay, did everybody hear that? Can someone come off of mute and just let me know if we're making it through?
No, that wasn't audible.
Okay, is that you, Peg?
Yeah.
Could you put yourself on mute too? Because I'm concerned that you might.
I was on mute.
Oh, okay. The procurement issues were being pointed out. That's something that person who does procurement for medications can arrange. The fourth item really is another policy issue, which is whether, in general, literature is being reviewed regularly to identify drug issues related to drug errors. such as, you know, labeling, packaging, nomenclature problems, and alerts. These are four questions that are really rather different from each other, but are just really all lumped in this one manufacturer labeling section. The next couple of questions are very specific to barcoding, and for those of you who don't have barcoding in place, probably your answer is going to be A, not implemented. For example, 5, an automated packaging solution to apply barcodes, you're not going to have that if you don't have barcoding. Whether the pharmacy computer system has a capability of printing labels with barcodes, I would say that if you don't have barcoding, you clearly don't have the capability of printing out barcodes. Number 7, the pharmacy computer system has a capability of printing label with barcodes for yet another type of drug. Again, if you don't have barcoding, that would be a no. The question as to whether the printers in the pharmacy, question number 8, that are used for labels have the capacity to produce a high-resolution barcode is a different kind of a question. And actually, I think this is probably the most difficult question in the entire survey. To me, how to know whether your printer has a resolution that's good enough to print out barcoding, I honestly don't know the answer to, and I'd be very curious to know if anyone in the who's on the call actually has a way of determining that. That might be something perhaps that we could do some more research on. Question number 9. Is a very important question that, again, we'll see asked in several other ways. Whether unit dose oral medications remain in the manufacturer's or the pharmacy's packaging up to the point of actual drug administration at the point of care. That's extremely important to prevent workarounds. Okay, you do not want the barcoded package to be opened up any time prior to the actual time of administration of the drug to the patient. Otherwise, you defeat the whole purpose of barcoding, which is to eliminate, in large part, administration errors. And again, if you're not doing barcoding now, you know, that may or may not be the case. Question number 10 asks whether or not when nurses are preparing injectable medications, the actual vial is brought to the bedside in general, rather than the syringe being drawn up at the nurse's station and then the syringe itself being brought over to the patient. And question number 11, we're going to see this question repeated in every section. This has to do with resource allocation. There's always a question at the end of each section on resource allocation. And in this case, whether repackaging costs have been factored into resource allocation. And let me open up for questions at this point because, I'm kind of like speaking to a phone here, so it helps me a little bit just to get some feedback from people as to whether or not they're having any particular problems with any individual questions in this first section. And then we'll go through each section like this and try to see what we can do with resolving issues or questions. If anyone wants to, please feel free to ask. If anybody wants to just acknowledge that this was pretty clear to them, then someone can come off of mute and just let me know.
It sounds clear to me, Charlie, but I would like one of the hospitals to, express whether or not it's clear to them. Did anyone have any questions regarding any of the topics that have been covered thus far or the questions that have been covered thus far?
Do you hear Bronx Lebanon right now?
Yes, go ahead.
I think that the questions are very straightforward, certainly not technically challenging. We didn't have any problems in the first section.
Okay, great. So I'll assume that that's the case for most hospitals, and we'll just move on to the second section. This now looks at drug standardization, storage, and distribution. Could folks put themselves on mute? We're getting a little noise. The two foci here are one on unit dose dispensing, and again, a lot of questions that are somewhat repetitious and somewhat overlapping, and then the second section looks at drug procurement and storage. Going to question 12, the issue has to do that when drugs are stocked in patient care units, like Pyxis machines, et cetera, are they stored in ready-to-use unit doses or not? Or if drugs are stocked at all in a nursing area, are they stocked in ready-to-use doses? That, you know, is something that either it's, you know, true or not. There are some exceptions to this that they've listed down here. Question number 13 is a question about whether single-dose vials or ampules are used for at least 90% of the injectable products commonly stored in patient care units. This is kind of the same question as the first one, almost, the way I see it. Question number 14 asks as to whether multiple-dose vials of insulin are dispensed from the pharmacy for individual patients. I actually have some problems with this question. I think the emphasis here is on individual patients. I think the question is really asking whether patients have dedicated multiple-dose vials, so that insulin apparently is an exception to the single unit dispensing because it's just impractical and everyone has a different dosage of insulin that's required. I mean, insulin is one of those medications that you prescribe in, you know, with varying doses depending on the patient. So therefore, you can't really do single-dose prescribing as easily, but they're asking here whether an individual vial is dedicated to an individual patient. Question number 15 looks at premixed IV solutions and asks whether there is a policy that premixed IV solutions be used whenever they're available. And the next question is related to this one and looks at whether those IV solutions that are not available commercially are prepared in the pharmacy as opposed to being prepared on the floor. And the idea behind this, again, has to do with barcoding. I mean, you can't, it is not really feasible to apply barcoding on the floor because you just don't have the computer set up there. You do not have the printer to be able to print out the barcoding. If you want to be consistent with barcoding, you've got to get as many of your source medications from the pharmacy as possible. So you need to minimize sort of ad hoc IV solution mixing at the floor level. There is an exception here for life-saving situations such as, you know, obviously codes or urgent kind of situations. Question number 17 is yet another variation that asks about unit dose dispensing specifically for IV push medications. Question number 18 is kind of the fail-safe fallback. It asks that in those cases, if there's a if the pharmacy is unable to or misses the opportunity to dispense medication in a patient-specific dose, is there some kind of process in place on the floor level, you know, at the nursing unit or in the patient the clinical area, to do some kind of a double check of the drug and dose calculation? Is there, you know, routinely two nurses that can counter-check each other on a drug and administration? Just from what I know about, you know, the kind of staffing that we're all faced with in hospitals and the situation, I think it would be admirable if this kind of thing existed. I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't exist in many cases, though. Yes, it is something that is routine for blood products, as Sue has mentioned, but I don't know how routine it is for just, you know, your average drug administration, giving an aspirin or giving a beta blocker, that kind of thing. Question 19 looks at the adequacy of the inventory. Is there on formulary enough dosage choices for medication to avoid the need to split tablets or to use multiple tablets? Question number 20 looks as whether or not oral liquid medications are distributed as unit doses. 21 looks at whether oral liquid pediatric antibiotics are distributed as unit doses. And question number 22, again, looks at, is that resource allocation question. I told you at every section there's that one sort of near the end. Have the costs of unit dose dispensing been factored into resource allocation calculations? And then the next couple of questions in this section are on drug procurement and storage. And 23 goes back to that principle that I talked about, which is that in order for barcoding really to work properly, without exception, to the greatest degree as possible, drugs have to originate from the pharmacy. So that's really what question 23 is asking. 24 is related to that. It asks whether or not patients' own personal medications that they bring in are avoided whenever possible, because that again would counter, would sort of prevent the full effectiveness of barcoding. 25 is self-explanatory, I think. 26 is a complicated question. First doses of high alert drugs are not removed from floor stock until a pharmacist reviews and screens a specific patient for safety. I guess this is really trying to get at I got momentarily confused. I think because of the redundancy in these questions, it's yet asking again that we try to avoid bypassing the barcoding system, especially where high alert drugs are concerned. That these are the drugs that you most certainly want to try to come from the pharmacy if possible. And 27 is just a general question whether you feel that the turnaround time is adequate. You know, is the pharmacy providing medications in a timely manner, depending on whether the patient needs an emergency dose or just a routine dose? And that completes the second set of questions. Again, if there are any, you know, issues, concerns, needs for clarification from hospitals, desires to discuss anything, please feel free to interrupt at any point. I'm going to now move on to the third section, which is focusing on environmental factors. And a lot of these questions in this particular section are kind of sort of assorted. Some of them are very general. That may make them either easier or harder to answer depending on the circumstance. The 28, whether or not your hospital has had successful experience with integrating and interfacing various information system technologies, I couldn't think of a more general question that is more subjective. Again, you know, I guess you're free to answer this one any way you feel, just honestly. Do you feel, number 29, that automated forms of IT are available in patient care units? They're talking here about, I think, mostly data entry type of thing, type of issues, whether computers, laptop, palm-held devices are being used across the board for patient notes, EMR, electronic medical administration record, that kind of thing. Orders for medication orders, et cetera. So if it is hard to find a computer on your floor, then you've not implemented this, in other words. Question 30, very subjective. Are inpatient and outpatient IT systems integrated? I guess the way I would try to operationalize this, I would say, is that if you are seeing a patient in an outpatient clinic in your hospital, can you pull up through your IT system information that is related to the latest hospitalization from that patient? Can you pull up labs? Can you pull up progress notes? Can you pull up radiology tests? That kind of thing. Question number 31 asks, again, kind of, you know, overlapping and duplicating many of the questions that have already been asked, whether IT is available at the point of care for nursing use specifically. Question number 32 asks a question that now skips back to barcoding technology, but looks at it in a wider context and asks not for medications now in specific, but for other uses in the hospital. Has barcoding been used for blood transfusions in the blood bank, for example? Are your blood units barcoded? Packed red blood cells. Is it being used for inventory control in central supply, for example? Now, these may be things you may have to speak to housekeeping about or blood bank about. You may not know offhand. Question 33 goes back to the IT system. Do you have the ability to pull up patient demographic information and location within the facility as appropriate? The way I would interpret this is as a computerized admission system. If you have a computerized admission system, which I think most people do. Question number 34, can your hospital interface handle the HL7 standard? Sue, do you want to comment a little on that? Because that goes a little bit over my head.
Basically, the HL7 standards are the standards for interfacing. So if you have the ability to interface your disparate applications is really all that's asking. It's HL7 interfacing.
Right, HL7, I mean, I know is one of the most commonly it's supposed to be sort of the de facto standard for interfacing clinical informatic technologies, and this might be a question you need to ask your CIO or your IT folks. If you have a very sophisticated system that's quite integrated, I would imagine they probably have HL7 integration then, would you think? Or
more than likely. Or an HL7 transaction.
Or an HL7 transaction. But that would be something to double check on, and that unfortunately I don't know a way of finding that out unless you actually speak to your IT folks.
Right.
35, I think, really asks about a wireless network. Do you have a wireless, either to internet or to CPOE? Question number 36, another one of these doozies for me. An application interface engine is available that would allow future IT systems to be fully integrated in the current technology infrastructure. Does that really exist, Sue, with such a thing? Okay, would you want to talk a little about it? No. is it possible? How would people go about finding whether or not they have such an interface engine?
Well, it's pretty easy. You're just going to go to your IT department, and the IT department will know what interface engine you're using.
Okay.
So
what are some types? What are some common types of interface engines?
There's a middleware.
It's called middleware?
Yes, for an application interface engine, you can be using OpenLink.
OpenLink.
Like, it varies if you're using the Siemens app.
Uh-huh.
Maybe somebody out there is from an IT department that can answer the question a little bit better, because I don't know what hospitals are using for
engines. But there are vendor-specific interface engines. And, for example, OpenLink is the interface engine for which?
That's what they use for the Siemens
application. For Siemens. Okay, so this actually is a question that needs to go back.
It's an IT question. Go to your IT department.
Okay. Okay.
That's so that you can know what application is handling the interfaces, how you're handling interfaces within that.
Okay. Okay. Question number 37 really asks whether you have a good inventory of your IT capabilities. Question 38, which I hope is going to be the case for everyone, is that your IT systems are protected with security and access control systems, such as password access.
And an audit trail.
An audit trail, and also the ability to determine which level of access different users can have, basically. So that you don't, by role. So you certainly want different access rights for someone in the admission office who doesn't need to see the patient's full chart versus the clinician who needs to see all the clinical data versus the pharmacist who may need to see some other specialized data, and on and on. Question number 39 looks at backups. Is there a policy or procedure in your institution to handle the need for the back to have a recovery plan in case there's in case the system goes down. Question number 40, again, is that resource allocation question, looking at whether or not hardware and software costs have been placed in the allocation plan. Moving on to physical environment, these are general questions that probably aren't so difficult to answer. 41, is there adequate space in the patient care unit for the various things you need for barcoding, such as medication equipment and hardware, including computer terminals? Question number 42, is there adequate space at the patient's bedside for the equipment and hardware associated with barcoded drug administration? And this really can vary. I mean, I've seen some hospitals just do it with a laptop on a rolling cart. So I'd say that depending on the technology you're deciding to use, virtually any setting could probably be accommodated. Question 43 asks if there's adequate space in the pharmacy if it's necessary to repackage meds into unit doses, as well as preparation of IVs and storage of unit dosage. Question 44 asks about sufficient electrical outlets in nursing stations. Question 45 asks about the resource allocation regarding physical environment charges, whether those costs have been factored in. And then moving on to question 46, now we're getting into workflow. And this is something where I think that many folks may actually fall down a bit, because you really need to examine your workflow. And 46 asks whether or not processes relating to whether process mapping has actually happened, because when you're going to be moving from the current system to barcoding, there's a need to understand how the roles of people change. Different people will now be responsible for different things. There will be some people that will have more work to do, some will have less work to do. Need for training for new roles as well. So 46 asks a general overview whether the current processes have been mapped so that the current workflow is well understood. 47, do the nurses follow procedures that are currently enforced for medication administration? 48, how much variation is there regarding administration? 49, do nurses prepare and administer only one patient's med at a time? Which means that they both prepare and then administer that med. So it's not like they prepare a whole bunch and then they administer a whole bunch, but do they prepare and administer each one? And I would think that that's not that common, just because of the shortages that we've got in terms of staffing and sheer volume of patients. Question number 50 is just, you know, has the new flow been looked at? Remember, question number 46 looked at whether the current flow of medication administration. I mean, question number 50 really asks whether the impact of barcoding and the changes in that flow have been looked at all. Question number 51 asks whether, and this is a somewhat different question now, do pharmacists routinely spend time in patient care units to observe the drug administration process and understand the barriers that exist to safe medication practices? We'll see later the same question is being asked of nurses a few questions down. Question number 52 asks, again, whether the processes associated with medication dispensing have been thoroughly examined. I think this is probably meant in the context of pharmacy, although pharmacists aren't mentioned in this question. 53, do pharmacists consistently follow existing processes? 54, has the impact of barcoding in terms of the change in workflow been examined as to how it's going to change pharmacist behavior, pharmacist roles, and pharmacist responsibilities? That's really what question 54 is getting at. And question 55 is the flip side of question 51 and asks whether or not nurses are routinely spending time in the pharmacy to observe the drug dispensing process and understanding the barriers to safe medication practices. I would think that while I've seen pharmacists come down to the floor and have some exposure to what goes on there. I think it's rather unusual for nurses as a group to have had significant experience in watching pharmacy function. I think it's I would be interested to know actually if hospitals have implemented this in terms of any kind of, you know, routine policy. I'd imagine it's something that most people have not done. And that pretty much wraps up the third and one of the more difficult sections on environmental factors. And I'd be happy to pause at this moment to see if there are any questions on any of the points that we've covered so far.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to just remind everyone that all of your lines are open, and if you're on a speakerphone, please disengage your mute function so that we can hear your question.
Okay, well, you know, again, feel free to interrupt at any time if questions do come up. We've got a few short, delightfully short sections to go, which I think will give us sort of the sense that we're moving along. We've actually covered quite a bit of the survey so far. But now we've got sections 4, 5, and 6, which are relatively brief and focus on patient information as well as drug information and then communication. And looking at patient information, going to question 56, a lot of these questions are not going to be the case if you're not doing barcoding currently. 56 asks whether a barcoded name band is applied to all inpatients. 57 asks whether a barcoded name band is applied to all outpatients for those areas of the outpatient clinic where patients spend an extended period of time, such as an oncology clinic or an ER. 58 asks, again, regarding that barcode, does it include a unique patient identification number? And if you're not doing barcoding, the answers to all of these are not implemented. Have question 59, have patient name bands been tested for durability? I don't exactly know. Sue, do you have is there a standard for durability? Do we know how to test patient?
Well, I mean, your manufacturer and the person that you purchased them from will be able to answer that better than I would.
Okay. So there's a manufacturing standard that they can...
But you do need to have a different type of band to be able to put a barcoded label on. There is a difference. So I actually have some information on that.
Okay. That would be very, very important for people to know. Is it a more durable band, or what are the features that make the band different from a...
The quality of this band is major determinant for both print on fluid resistant labels using thermal printing.
Oh, okay. So that they can't be, they have to be smear resistant.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very key. And durability means that. Okay, so you know what? I think that we're probably going to cover more of this when we get to the specifics. We actually have quite a, you know, intensive educational program planned for the next 2 years. So each one of these areas will be focused in a whole lot more. But at any rate, your manufacturer will be able to test the patient name bands for durability. Number 60 looks at whether name bands could be reapplied in the event the band's been removed or rendered unreadable. 61 prohibits printing multiple name bands for patients, which means, I guess, using multiple numbers or multiple ID codes.
Because if they print out a name band, a wristband for the patient when they are admitted and find out that they already have another patient record, then they would have to take off that wristband and then merge the records and give them the old patient record.
Okay. So in other words, there needs to be a constant reconciliation with the most original patient record number. 62, I hope everyone understood that 61 really means that if a patient gets a barcode number and is subsequently found to have a different medical record chart number, then the barcode needs to be removed from the patient's wrist and then a new one needs to be affixed that reflects their underlying medical record number. Number 62 just asks whether or not the same barcoding technology is used to identify lab specimens and blood collection specimens. Question 63 asks a question about medication entry, whether it interfaces directly with the lab system. Question 64 asks whether medication order entry alerts practitioners to possible drug therapy changes based on current laboratory values. So 63 and 64 are related questions. So that, for example, you know, a patient who's getting KLOR and his last potassium was 6.1, it would be nice if, as you're doing the barcoding and entering the KLOR prescription in at the point of care, when you scan that KLOR, something pops up on the laptop screen to tell you, alert, you know, do not give KLOR to this patient, or check with physician first because potassium currently is 6.1. This is the kind of, you know, medication error prevention that we're trying to get into place. Number 65 asks the same question about whether there's a link between pharmacy and patient allergies, so that, again, there can be an alert in case a drug has been ordered that a patient's allergic to. And 66 asks about a link that's more sophisticated, I think, between pharmacy computer system and the patient's weights, which will allow the entry system to determine at the moment the patient is receiving the med whether or not the dose is wrong for the patient's particular weight and height, whether they're being overdosed or potentially underdosed. The next section is section 5, and I'm just going to go without a pause through these. Again, feel free to interrupt me if there's any questions, but section 5 is another short one focused on drug information. 67 asks whether the NDC codes are being used as the primary index for listing of drugs in the pharmacy computer system. Sue, do you know whether or not that's a common thing? I would imagine that that's almost universal, wouldn't you? Sue also agrees that that's probably universal, so I'm not quite sure why they even are asking the question. 68, this is one of those that I thought was a little controversial from my particular clinical point of view. 68 asks whether the hospital formulary contains almost no duplication of generic equivalents and very minimal duplication of therapeutically equivalent products. Now, that may simplify barcoding to have, you know, very minimal duplication, but as someone who has treated patients, I can tell you that I like to have a choice as a physician, even for those drugs where they're theoretically equivalent, you know, when it comes to, well, you know, non-steroidal response, or when it comes to, you know, antibiotics or whatever, there's so many idiosyncrasies and idiosyncratic responses among patients that, you know, I don't want to dwell on this because I don't want to waste everybody's time, but I just want to point out that we may not all agree that all these questions are actually good ones. So, yes, here, question 68 may facilitate barcoding, but I don't know if I agree from a total clinical standpoint that it's really desirable. Question 69 asks whether non-formulary product use is limited. I would imagine that's probably the case in most hospitals. Number 70, very picky question as to whether non-formulary products are entered into the pharmacy computer system with an NDC number or unique drug code use before use. I would imagine so. I mean, again, if the systems are pretty universally attuned to NDC codes, I'd imagine that's usually the case. But you could check with your pharmacist, and if anyone finds out that there are exceptions to that, I'd be very, very interested. 71 asks whether formulary decisions are based in part on whether a product is available in unit dose packaging. Interesting question. I guess they're implying that that would be a rational and reasonable criteria for determining what belongs on a formulary. 72, do vendor contracts reflect preferential purchasing of unit doses with barcodes? Number 73, are drug information updates for computer systems received from a database vendor and loaded at least quarterly? I think you're going to have to check with your IT folks on this one. I think that there are many vendors who provide pharmacy products that automatically provide this kind of a service, but I'm not sure. Sue, do you agree?
First Data Bank.
First Data Bank is one of them?
Yeah, there's plenty of them.
There are many of them. So chances are that your hospital is doing this already.
Almost every hospital.
Almost every hospital, according to Sue. Okay. Question number 74, that just maximum doses for high alert drugs have been established and are available in the pharmacy computer system for dose range check, so that, you know, you're going to want to minimize the risk of overdosing on chemo, you know, giving overdosing on morphine, et cetera. That concludes on our Section 5. And now I'm moving on to Section 6, communication of drug orders and other drug information. And this really, the first, most of this is looking at medication administration records. Number 75 is asking two things. Number one, is there a computer-generated or electronic MAR, and does that MAR share a common database with the pharmacy system? So is it essentially tied in to the pharmacy system? And that's rather similar to some of the questions we've seen a few pages ago, which looked at whether the MAR, you know, is linked to the pharmacy system. So this is, again, I was talking about a little bit of the redundancy. We're asking many of the same questions just in a slightly different way. 76, do nurses consistently throughout all inpatient units use the same MAR? Question 77, again, is all inpatient medication administration documented on a single MAR? Question 78, very subjective question, but you can ask your pharmacist whether, if since the MAR is shared by both the nursing and the pharmacy departments, it would be ideal if the pharmacists who are entering the orders would do it in such a way so that it would be kind of nurse-friendly, you know, kind of eliminate those unnecessary informations that are important only to the pharmacy, as well as pointing out, perhaps making comments and pointing out things that nurses should be looking out for when they're administering these medications. 79 asks whether MARs are available at the point of care, at the patient's bedside. Again, I'd say this is really asking whether, you know, you've got access to a PDA or laptop-based MAR. Question 80, are standardized times for routine drug administration established and followed consistently? I guess what they're really asking is, does the hospital have a policy that if you say TID, you know exactly what hours those are? Or if you, you know, essentially that. Question 81, do all nurses have a barcoded name badge? Because part of the process of doing barcoding is that you scan your own name badge prior to actually giving the medication. So you've got to scan your own name badge, scan the patient's barcode on their wristband, and then scan the medication barcode. So those are sort of like the components of it. So all nurses need to have that. 82, are all prescriber orders for inpatients forwarded to the pharmacy, including those that do not specifically include medication orders? Sounds kind of general to me, but do you see a point to that, Sue? Is there any? Well, it's not to either of us. We don't quite get the point of this question. It sounds kind of general, but I'd be interested to know if out there someone has a sense of what that question is trying to get at. I would imagine the answer is going to be yes. I'll pause again for a moment to see if there are any questions so far. Right. You know, actually, Sue just pointed out whether or not the question is for question 82, for those kind of Tylenol type orders that, you know, are often given on the floor, are those forwarded to the pharmacy as well? And I guess Tylenol orders are a potential source of medication error, so maybe that's what they're looking at. I'm going to move on to section number 7, which looks at staff competency and education. A lot of this has to do with you know, staffing, what kind of qualifications the staff has, what kind of interactive educations and programs, training programs are available for staff in preparation for barcoding. Question number 83 asks whether, and this is a very specific question, whether your IT staff includes personnel with specialty training in clinical informatics. Now, clinical informatics is not like knowing how to code in Java or COBOL or, you know, C or one of those languages, but it asks specifically whether or not there's someone on your IT staff that has had training in health informatics, medical informatics, clinical informatics, which represent sort of the intersection between IT and medical care, health care. This is a special discipline that not necessarily that many people in IT have, but it is extremely helpful and extremely important to try to find someone or to try to hire someone who has this kind of training, because for someone with IT to know enough about clinical medicine and to have had that clinical informatics background, they can interpret the needs of clinicians much, much better than, you know, someone who comes straight from really the financial billing side or the administration, admission medical record side. You need someone who can speak the language of clinical medicine and yet has an IT background. And that's why it's so important to try to have someone on board with a training specifically in this area. 84 asks whether that person actually has a leadership and decision-making role. And 85 now asks, now leaving the IT staff, looking at the clinical staff, asks sort of questions on the clinical side. Do nurses have experience using computerized information technology? And really, if in your hospital you already have EMRs or EMARs, electronic medication administration records, then by default you already do have experience because your nurses have been using it. 86 asks the question about physicians. Have they had opportunities to use computerized systems in the hospital? And 87 asks whether you try to limit people who have not had that kind of experience. The use of periodic nursing and pharmacy agency, it's looking at temps, I'm sorry. Okay, 87 is looking at temps and floaters, okay. Whether there's an attempt to try to limit the use of temps and floaters. Again, I think it all has to do with the issues of trying to maintain uniform training, that if you're putting some of these high-tech systems in and then you just bring in agency people or floaters, they're not going to be...
Or
per diems, they're not going to be sophisticated, and they're going to have trouble interfacing these systems. Question, now we're skipping to education, and these are some general questions. 88 asks whether in the past year either educational programs or interactive discussions have been held with people who are on the front line in clinical staff about barcoding. 89 asks whether these kinds of programs or discussions have been held with senior leaders in the past year. Question number 90 actually is a very interesting question. It asks whether or not you've stirred the pot. Have you actually explored the possible unintended consequences of barcoding? Have there been discussions looking specifically, trying to uncover potential anxieties and dissatisfactions that might emerge as a result of these technologies? I think that's very important, and I'm really glad they put that question in here, because I believe that you do not harm your preparation at all by trying to evoke negative responses. Rather, these negative responses are probably inevitable at some point, and by just deliberately facilitating them and exploring them up front, I think you can be very proactive about being alerted to what kinds of ways you can avoid those sorts of bad outcomes for BPOC. So this is really a good tip. 91, very important, you know, your vendors are going to be setting the system up, and you really need to be able to maintain the system when your vendors go. So do you feel confident that you have qualified hospital personnel that can continue to support training and do technological support after the vendor steps out of the picture? That's part of the preparation and the maintenance. 92 asks about physicians' education needs. Have they been considered? 93 looks at whether training includes handling technological failure. So in other words, Sue, do you have any comments on this? I guess if the system breaks down, how do they?
It's backup plan.
Backup plan
for downtime.
For downtime.
It's really, you know, make sure that do you have downtime procedures, and usually for any clinical that you are supporting, you're going to have downtime procedures.
Okay, so that.
So it's how do I revert to paper? What happens if my clinical system is down? How do you handle stat orders? How do you handle your PRNs at that point? How do you handle your standing med orders? What do you do when your systems are down? So doctor needs this medication immediately. Who's going to do the running? You know, who's a runner? What are you going to do for that?
Okay, because roles will switch back. Roles will revert. And for people who now get used to the new roles, of, you know, facilitated by the technology, there needs to be a way to revert back to the old roles,
right.
Upon, you know, at an instant, essentially, if the system goes down, and that's
right.
That can be challenging. 94 is that, but it is critical. 94 is that resource allocation plan again. Has training been factored in to the resource allocation plans? And now that concludes staff competency and education. Section number 8, which is very short, looks at patient education, and there are only 4 questions in this section. 95 points out that there need to be educational materials for patients as well, and that this needs to be put into place, and asks whether it's been implemented yet, specifically regarding BARC. 96 asks whether patients are routinely provided with their medication list. 97 asks whether there have been press releases or any kind of public announcements from the hospital announcing the implementation of barcoding. And 98 asks whether or not there's input from someone from the community on the panel, the patient safety committee or panel that evaluates all of these technologies. It's kind of a general question. And that really brings us to the last section, which is maybe the longest one, but we are near the end of sort of this once through on this survey. And we're doing pretty well as far as time, because I think we have dedicated 2 hours for this call, and we're just a little bit over 1 hour now. My guess is that this last section probably will take perhaps another 15 minutes because it is so long. But I'll pause here for a moment to see if anyone has any questions up to now. And if not, then we'll move ahead. Now, this is a section that touches a little bit on senior administration and senior management and board issues. So, you know, you might want to try to touch base with some of your chief officers to find out what, you know, their opinions are on some of these things. Or you may be able to basically infer many of these answers just on the basis of the kinds of communications that you've had with your senior administration. And I think that I encourage the second. Of course, the first is better wherever possible, but I encourage the second because I would hate to think that, you know, the surveys will be held up just because, you know, you haven't had a chance to talk with board members. I mean, it just may not be feasible in some cases to be able to have access like that, you know, just at a moment's notice. But let's go through some of these questions. 99 really looks at the alignment of board of the board with patient safety issues. You know, do they, are they committed, and have they demonstrated their commitment in one of several ways? Safety plan, encouraging practitioner error reporting, and do they encourage technology? Question 100 really asks it generally, are senior leaders in the board committed to expanding the use of clinically proven technologies to improve medication safety? And 101 I guess, looks at your clinical information system strategy and asks whether barcoding fits in well with your current IT direction. 102 asks about the business case. Have you sat down and actually constructed a business case for barcoding? And has it been sort of voted upon and endorsed by senior leadership? So this would kind of be your timeline in a way. You know, have the expenditures been laid out? Have the expected benefits been projected? And has this been put into a financial spreadsheet, sort of in terms of a flow? 103 is a very related question. Whether the same bar, I think it's so close to 102 that I'm not going to go over it. 104 asks whether the goals of barcoding are part of the hospital strategic plan. Earlier we asked whether it was part of the clinical information department. Here it's asking whether it's part of the hospital's overall strategic plan. Does it fit into the hospital's mission statement, vision statement, et cetera? 105, kind of, again, one of these relatively duplicative questions, but it's asking now more specifically not just whether, as in question 100, whether senior leaders and board are committed to expanding clinically proven technologies, but are they specifically committed to allocating resources necessary to implement barcoding? And 106, it's actually making me chuckle, this question. Have senior leaders taken steps to ensure that the expenditure and implementation of barcoded drug administration technology will not create relationship problems, excuse me for laughing, with other departments in the hospital or the medical staff? Enough said. Question 107. A question now asking about problems with labor unions regarding job responsibilities. Sue, do you have any experience with
yes,
that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, would you?
Actually, at one of the hospitals that I was the director of IT in New York City, actually it was in the Bronx, we had an issue with the labor union for both the nurses and the nursing assistants. What happened was it was part of their union contract that they were not to be forced to use any kind of information technology as part of their job. So you have to review with your unions prior to implementing what are the restrictions on your union personnel. It's a very important fact and you need a factor, and you need to evaluate this up front before you even get involved in this type of an implementation. I just want to really address that because we had a big issue with that, and we had to go into a whole labor contract renegotiation with our union. So it became a very big barrier in technology for us.
Okay, thanks, Sue. That's Sue's own personal experience with that issue, so definitely something to pay attention to and not forget to do. Again, as a checklist, I think this is a great tool. 108, another very important issue, whether senior leaders have involved nurses and pharmacists, the people who are on the front lines actually giving clinical care, in the initial discussions and planning meetings. We just know of too many cases where if you do not involve the people who are actually going to be using the system up front in making many of the decisions, including, you know, many of the options in the system and many of the way the screen is going to be laid out, the functionality, the workflow, if you do not involve the nurses and the pharmacists, and this is true with CPOE as well as barcoding, you're going to make life a lot more difficult for yourselves.
Including your clerks.
And clerks as well.
Registration
staff. 109
skips to the question as to whether somebody is going to be monitoring regarding regulations concerning barcoding, okay, because barcoding issues, you know, are legal issues as well. They change over time, and you've got to have somebody assigned to reviewing FDA, JCO, AHA, and other types of regulations as they come out so that you can keep up to date with how your system is functioning.
Normally, your HIM director will take that role on. They're usually very good with that, so make sure that your HIM director is a big part of your team, because they will be able to continue to make sure, or your risk manager as well.
Question number 110, maybe this is something here. State licensing regulations have been examined to ensure compliance with medication repackaging standards. Any experience with that, Sue, at all? Not really. I guess, you know, I'm not really entirely sure what that refers to. My guess is that very few of us has probably implemented that then.
I'm going to say that I did quite a couple of these implementations, and I'm not sure about state licensing regulations.
Okay. I'm not sure if this is referring to the regulations at the provider level, at the institution level. So I have to say this one question's a bit vague for me. I'm not quite getting that. Of course, if anyone out there has some insight, I'd be very happy to hear. But for now, they would probably be safe to put not implemented if we're not sure what it's really asking. 111, well, when you're going to be having a vendor, you need to know how to choose your vendor. And really, 111 means that you've actually come up with criteria for how to choose your vendor based on experience, service, technology, et cetera. And that's really when you're kind of right at the step before system selection and purchasing. Question 112. Now we're getting into multidisciplinary teams and committees, and a lot of these questions, some of them don't directly relate to barcoding and some do. The first question is just very general. Do you have multidisciplinary committees that include information technology staff working together to improve patient safety? Not anything specific about barcoding in question 112. Question 113, now we get into barcoding a little bit more. Have we identified any clinical or clinical informatics champions? This is very important. Sue wants to talk a little about that.
It's a key to success to identify your clinical champions up front, people that are going to stay with your institution. It goes back to that question with regard to, do you have someone who can continuously support and train the application? Make sure that you identify those users, those particular participants or users up front, so that you know you will have a consistent source of information and support throughout both the implementation and, you know, as you're growing and using the system.
Okay. Thanks, Sue. And again, for many folks who've not yet gotten this close to implementing barcoding, I think the answers are going to be not implemented for many of you. Question 114 is very, I love this question. I'm glad they have it here, that specifically in the process of selecting a vendor, it's not something that IT just does on their own. This is something that a multidisciplinary team does, that this team that includes clinicians, clinical informatics staff, clinical managers, risk managers, and senior leaders together as a group select a vendor. And that this question is asking whether or not that team has already been set up and is ready to go ahead and proceed to select a vendor. 115 talks about empowerment of that team. Does the team that has been set up actually have the authority to set timelines, deadlines, actually define processes, and work closely with the users of the system? Have times been made for the frontline clinicians to be able to meet with this group so that, you know, the people who are actually going to be using the system can interface with the group and express their needs. Question 116, it's a very good idea if you can do it. We've done it here at iPro as we were learning more and more about barcoding. We visited hospitals that used it. It is great. You can find, one of the things we hope to provide in this project, in the IPG, is access to hospitals that have already successfully implemented barcoding, to actually be able to go to other hospitals to send clinical and clinical informatics representatives to visit hospitals where barcoding already is functioning well, so you can observe some of the roles, how the workflow has been changed, et cetera. 117 looks at troubleshooting, whether nurses and pharmacists have looked at the potential failure points and risks. 118, again, asks whether or not there's ongoing literature search to learn about potential sources of error with new technology, including barcoding. Kind of related to the question we had a few questions ago about keeping up to date with regulations, this is really just asking whether you're going to keep up to date with barcoding as a field. 119 is that resource allocation question. So our FTEs in the resource allocation have salary times dedicated to these multidisciplinary teams, dedicated to educational sessions. Has this all been factored in to the business plan? Question number 120, and we're sort of starting to head into the home stretch here, which is nice. The next five questions or so are extremely important, but yet they're rather global questions about your safety culture. And it may be hard to come up with good answers on these because these are very subjective. And I think that do your best is all I can say, because there are going to be different answers on some of these from different points of view from different people in your institution. But wherever you can get a consensus, it would be helpful. Do you feel you have a blame-free culture? That's really 120. Is there an open ability to discuss errors without this fear of reprisal? 121 asks, other than egregious errors, whether disciplinary action is taken routinely against people who make essentially human error, almost expected human error. Those occasional medication errors that can lead to patient adverse outcomes and can lead to patient harm, but yet are unintentional and are, either ordering, transcribing, or administration errors that unfortunately do happen because we're all human. Do they happen, and is disciplinary action taken against clinicians? Or is it not taken? That's the ideal, is that no disciplinary action should be taken in those circumstances. But rather, the process itself should be studied to figure out what went wrong. 122 is related to that and asks whether your hospital avoids using medication errors as a measure of employee competence during a evaluation. 123 asks whether near misses are reported as well as actual errors. So do you have an aggressive way to track near misses that get caught before they reach the patient, but still had the potential to be missed and to actually cause patient harm? And 124 is essentially the same question. 125 asks whether discussions with nurses and pharmacists have been put into place to deal with the fact that more errors are going to be triggered, because barcoding, because it's like quote-unquote a more perfect system, is going to uncover more human errors, and it's going to be tracked now electronically as opposed to being tracked on a voluntary basis. It's almost going to be an involuntary electronic sort of tracking. So are people prepared for the fact that even if they've never been identified in the past, perhaps, as having made a medication error, they will most likely at some point get sort of tracked once barcoding goes into place? 126, you know, are free discussions encouraged amongst multiple specialties in the form of a focus group to try to, you know, troubleshoot problems on medication use? 127 asks, do nurses feel comfortable reporting barriers they encounter? 128 asks whether pharmacists feel comfortable reporting and discussing barriers. 129 really asks the general question whether or not you're doing root cause analysis or failure mode defect analysis to try to troubleshoot patient safety as it relates to medications. 130, very important, 130. This is actually a question that we here at iPro have been asking all hospitals as we've been going through our recruitment for the IPGs, whether or not reporting to senior leadership and to the board is direct. Is there regular, meaningful reports to senior leaders in the board about progress with medication safety objectives? When we've been recruiting for the other IPGs, such as ACM and SCIP, it's a very important component, we think, of how you know, how priorities can be well measured to see how interested the board is in actually getting direct reports on patient safety. 131. Are medication safety objectives celebrated and widely communicated when met? So do you have posters on the wall, you know, sort of tracking medication safety? Does the hospital have a little party, I guess, you know, if you've had a success in this area? And the last couple of questions, 132, is there an interest expressed by the board, senior leaders, and clinicians? 133, really, again, a question about interest. The first question about interest, 132, really asks, is there an interest in intercepting potential medication errors? 133 asks, is there an interest in detecting medication errors? Number 134 asks, is there a desire to measure medication safety? These sound so general to me, and they really all overlap with each other. 135 is the resource question. Have time and resources been allocated to analyze and use averted error data generated by a barcode system? Okay, well, that's an important question. 135 really asks, you're going to be getting a lot of data from your barcoding system, including a lot of those near misses that are now going to be electronically reported. How are they going to be used? How are these reports going to be used to educate the staff in a non-punitive way to try to, you know, prevent these kinds of errors? And I think it's important to realize that BPOC is also not 100% perfect, because just because you're going to have a computerized inventory and medical administration system doesn't mean that you can switch. We can all switch our brains off now. You know, it's still, there are always going to be unintended consequences, and there are always going to be, you know, some holes through BPOC through which errors can yet still occur. So we need to always be vigilant. We need to always be alert, and we always need to improve. So those near misses that barcoding picks up, we still need to learn from and perfect our processes.
There are some upfront challenges you're going to want to be aware of, so especially evaluate during your planning process, such as your wireless infrastructure. Very, very important, because you could have some weak access points blind spots on the units, so that's very important to take a look at. Also, as we were talking about before, the wristbands, they have to be comfortable, yet they have to be able to accommodate appropriate font size, so that not only is the barcode readable by the staff member, but it also has to be readable by the barcode reader. And In addition to that, we were talking before about printers and things like that. You know, if you currently support dot matrix printers, they're not going to be good enough. And laser printers are okay, but you want to think about having thermal printers and thermal direct printers. Anyway, we'll talk further about that at another time. I just wanted to explain to you that there are some challenges. There are going to be some challenges, and as the project moves on, we'll be able to talk about those challenges. So just expect that they do exist.
Thank you very much, Sue. That essentially, you know, kind of brings us through the survey on a once-through kind of, you know, exploration. I would encourage people to try to really complete these surveys as quickly as possible because they are prerequisites for joining the HIT. I understand, of course, that, you know, some will definitely feel the need or desire to check in with some IT folks or pharmacy and nurse clinicians regarding some of the issues that were brought up. Others will feel comfortable in perhaps, you know, if they have more direct experience themselves on the floor with filling in more of these questions. I personally am always available for any questions on, you know, any of these sections, so you can always feel free to just give me a direct call. And I will, you know, do what I can to try to clarify or try to expound, or if there's a question that, you know, doesn't appear to be so easy to answer, we can post it up on our question board because the QIOs have access to a question board and we can see what other QIOs feel or what some of the national experts feel in some of these questions. So let me open up. Oh, and one other thing I mentioned is that we will be forwarding to everybody an electronic version of the survey in an Excel spreadsheet. And but we don't really care which way you send it back to us. One of the advantages of an electronic spreadsheet is that you can email it back to us. If you do it on paper, you're most likely going to have to just mail it back in, which is fine, although, by the way, please make a copy for yourself as well, obviously, before mailing it in. But an advantage of the Excel spreadsheet is that it can be filled out and it can be emailed back, and I'll be forwarding everybody a copy of that by email sometime later today. Other than that, I do hope that going over it once, it's a very, very long survey. It has some very excellent points, as we've mentioned, and you know, we've tried to kind of add value a little bit here and there where we had something important we felt to say on some of the questions. But keep in mind that this really is not a perfect survey. I don't think, you know, any survey of this length can be. And do your best is basically all I can really ask. And at this point, let's open for one last round of questions, see if anybody has any. Debbie?
Ladies and gentlemen, just that final reminder, your lines are all open. You may ask your question at any time. Disengage your mute function. That will allow us to hear you.
I have a question for the audience. Has anybody begun to complete this assessment tool, or has anyone completed it?
Rob Sabanon, we have started already. We plan to finish today.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. And you didn't have any difficulty with the completion of it?
No, not at all.
Okay, great. And did you have medicine as well as IT and nursing involved in the completion of it?
We actually have right now here a group of IT, nursing, pharmacy, and the only one missing is a physician, which we'll be contacting shortly.
Okay, great. And is it something that you already have in use in the hospital and you're going to expand on, or is this a whole new endeavor for you?
Well, the BPOC is a new endeavor, although we just completed our CPOE implementation.
Right, right.
So
this is the next step.
Yeah, that's the missing link right now, is the BPOC features. Other than that, there was some few minor adjustments in pharmacy. I think we are in good shape, and in fact, we are looking to implement BPOC early next year.
Oh, great. Great. Well, I hope that this will, I'm sure it will be helpful to you, and I'm sure that, you know, working on the plan will help you also as you move forward. And I'm sure that you'll be able to share a lot of what you're doing. You might be ahead of the curve. Certainly, it sounds like you're ahead of the curve in terms of some of the hospitals that we'll be working with. So you'll be able to share your experiences with us.
It will be our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I thank everyone for listening in. I hope that it's been helpful. If you run across any stumbling blocks, as Dr. Stimler said, please feel free to give us a call. I would ask that you go on to jenny.ipro.org. There is an evaluation tool there. We would appreciate it if you would fill that out. It's under the conference call information for health information technology. And again, if anyone has any questions, we'll take them before we conclude the call. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude the conference, and you may now disconnect.